Just before you start listening to this podcast, a reminder that we have a special subscription offer. You can get 12 issues of The Spectator for £12, as well as a £20 Amazon voucher. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher if you'd like to get this offer. Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, The Spectator's daily and sometimes more than daily politics podcast. I'm Katie Balls and I'm joined by James Forsyth and Isabel Hardman. So there are many government decisions looming, and one of the biggest is the future of HS2, the high-speed rail link. There's a report today in the Financial Times that the Government Commission review, that report is currently unpublished, is going to suggest that on balance, HS2 should go ahead. However, it is heavily caveated. There is a point in it that the cost could soar to £106 billion, and there are other issues in terms of further concerns. James, is this a sign that it is going to happen, or what is the process from this report?
I think this review leaves the decision very much up to Boris Johnson. It doesn't come back saying it should definitely go ahead, it's going to provide great economic benefit to the West Midlands, nor does it come back saying you must scrap this now because the costs are going to just spiral even further than the extra 20 billion. I think there is a real question here about HS2, which is how did the cost end up tripling? You know, what was going on? And someone I know who is very supportive of HS2 as a project has been saying for a while that there is an HS2 management problem here, which is going to end up sucking public support for the project. I think the political difficulty for Boris Johnson is obvious, which is however tempting it is to scrap this because of the amount of money it would free up to spend on other projects, and you've already had Tory MPs in northern seats saying, well, hang on a second, if you didn't do HS2, think of all the other bits of transport projects you could do in the north. He has a problem, though, because to scrap HS2 would go rather against his idea that he is the infrastructure levelling up Prime Minister, and it would also cause a lot of political difficulties for Andy Street, the Tory Mayor of the West Midlands, who is up for re-election this year, and who the Tories are very keen to see get back in. And Andy Street is the least ambivalent person on HS2 there is. He basically says that, you know, the whole reason he argues that Birmingham is undergoing this economic renaissance, that its sluggish growth rate is finally increasing, is because people know that HS2 is coming. And so I still think it's very hard. I also think that all of Boris Johnson's actions are not the actions of somebody who wants to scrap HS2. During that Tory leadership contest, it would have been an easy applause line to say you're getting rid of it. It is not a popular project in the Tory party. All Boris Johnson promised was a review. And I just wonder whether it will end up happening in a slightly scaled back form, but it will end up happening. But I think that HS2 is definitely in more danger now than it has been at any point previously.
Isabel, this government has surprised some in its first few weeks. Now it has a majority of 80, in the sense that there hasn't been so much drama. In a way, they've been moving away from the limelight on various issues. And some would say that Boris Johnson has been risk averse. Do you think that Boris Johnson is ready for the backlash that would come from scrapping HS2?
I think it will be, as James says, it will be very difficult for him for seats in the Midlands, including the West Midlands mayoral contest, which is tight, to say the least. But if you talk to Conservative MPs, particularly new Conservative MPs who won seats in the North, they will say that their constituents are far less bothered by the greater connectivity and capacity between the North and London. And actually, for them, it's about the sort of trans-northern route, going between Manchester and Leeds and so on. And this Oakerby report, which hasn't been published, but which obviously has been leaked to the FT, does say that if HS2 does go ahead, it has to be accompanied by a lot of investment in local transport as well. And this is something that, you know, any MP who you talk to in these seats will say, that actually their constituents will be unmoved one way or the other by HS2. What they're looking for is whether or not their trains are going to turn up on time between cities rather than moving between London. And, you know, if anyone who's tried to travel from Manchester to Leeds will tell you that it is horrendous, and that should be the focus of any sort of big decisions around infrastructure, as opposed to from London to the north. But levelling up doesn't just include the north of England. And Boris Johnson has been very clear that it also includes the Midlands. And so it is going to be difficult for him. And as you say, this would be the first sort of public backlash he's faced. But let's not forget that he's managed somehow to, in the space of a decade, promise to lie down in front of the bulldozers for Heathrow expansion. And yet Heathrow expansion is still going ahead and Boris Johnson is still intact.
James, when it comes to the second part, Isabel touched on where actually lots of MPs feel the push should be. In this report, it calls for work on the second phase of the link, so from the West Midlands to Manchester and Leeds, to be put on hold for 6 months to explore whether it could be made of a mix of standard and high-speed rail. Do you think that this is where the political focus of the government is when it comes to where the focus should be on the plans for rail, whether it's HS2 or a different form of rail?
I think Isabel's right. The thing that everyone wants to see is greater east-west connectivity, and also, you know, that basically getting Leeds to Manchester to be fast. You know, I mean, that is no distance at all, but it takes a remarkably long time by public transport. And I think one of the things you've got to start thinking about is, you know, one of the reasons why London is such a successful city is you can live in Guildford and get into London on the train in half an hour or so, right? In large sections of the north, you know, you don't have that relationship between smaller places and big cities, and that is one of the things that has left some of these towns behind, which is, you know, they are not connected. You know, towns that in the south would be connected to London very easily, very straightforwardly, in the north are not connected to Manchester, Leeds or Newcastle, for example, and that is part of what is holding them back economically. On Isabel's point on Heathrow, I do think this will partly play a role. I think that Boris Johnson would still like to find a reason for the Heathrow expansion not to go ahead. It would, for all the reasons Isabel outlined, be very difficult for him politically, for him to be Prime Minister when they start actually sending, you know, the bulldozers in to build this third runway. And I think in a way, though, it then comes out, this whole thing then begins to bleed into the HS2 decision, which is, you know, to scrap one infrastructure project on the grounds that you no longer want to proceed with it is one thing, but to scrap two when you are going to be the infrastructure prime minister, I think that becomes harder. And I wonder whether that might be one of the things that helps HS2 squeak over the line, which is this sense of, well, I still want to reserve my right to find some way for Heathrow expansion, the third runway, not to happen. So I will go ahead with HS2 because that's kind of one big project that's getting the go-ahead.
No, on infrastructure, we haven't got to any bridge building yet, which we know is Boris Johnson's preferred method usually. Now, elsewhere, we've had Labour candidates for the leadership race talking about various issues and some focusing on the Midlands and North and how the party can regain voters there. But over the weekend, we had the first Labour leadership hustings. Isabel, you were watching. What did we learn since it happened? We've had one candidate disown the former. I think actually two, now I think about
disown
it. Lisa Nandy
as well.
Yeah, Jess Phillips has disowned herself. Lisa Nandy's called for longer answers. Was it really such an awful showing?
It wasn't awful. It was just very... It just lacked the challenge that the party faces. And so, as Jess Phillips and Lisa Nandy have both complained, you get 40 seconds to give your answer and there's no sort of back and forth between the candidates. So if you want to have a go at a fellow candidate, as Jess Phillips did on a couple of occasions, you have to do that in your first answer because it is your only answer. And it's only if the other candidates go after you that they get a sort of attempt to come back at what you've accused them of. So Jess Phillips did this on anti-Semitism and on a couple of other things. She said that she couldn't remember the people around her on the stage being in the room when she was trying to deal with the need for a proper complaints process. And sort of Keir Starmer and Emily Thornberry come back on that. But it wasn't a debate about the party's future. It was just people trying to sort of regurgitate lines before they got cut off. But I don't think they can just blame the format. I think this is also the position that most of them are taking, particularly Keir Starmer, who, as the front runner, is running even more of a safety first campaign than Keir Starmer would instinctively run. It was very much, from all of them, about flattering the membership. And this is partly because it was held in Liverpool, which has got a very strong Labour presence. There were pledges from Keir Starmer, for instance, that he wasn't going to give an interview to The Sun in this campaign, and it got a big cheer, although later
4 months.
Yeah, 4 months, go on. But it was very much aimed at a membership that doesn't see a need for the party to change drastically. So the challenging things that the candidates were saying were things like, we need to win an election, which, you know, apparently is going to strike fear into the heart of Labour members because winning an election is scary, rather than sort of repudiating Labour policies, saying that the party has, you know, moved too far to the left, for instance. That the next day, as well as writing this piece saying that she was awful, Jess Phillips also, she was on PNR's Politics, and she was asked about renationalising industries. And she said that renationalising would never be her priority. And I think if that's as challenging as candidates who think they're going to lose are prepared to go, then whoever becomes Labour leader is either not going to confront the party's biggest problems or is not being straight with their party electorate at the moment about how much they're going to change things, because it is not a contest at the moment that reflects the scale of the party's electoral challenge.
No, finally, James, so have some Labour candidates who may be around for some time to come if they triumph in this contest. But there's also some Labour figures who look as though they're going to be in the Houses of Parliament indefinitely. We have word this weekend via a report in the Sunday Times that Jeremy Corbyn's dissolution honours are looking rather interesting. Up for a peerage, or as we believe have been proposed, John Bercow, as well as Carrie Murphy, the former, well, still technically in post, actually, an advisor to Jeremy Corbyn, who is still for now the Labour leader. This is a slightly strange look, isn't it? Given that also Tom Watson, lots of these people have been very critical of the Lords in the past, and Labour have been critical of Conservative leaders when they have done this on their own bat, suggesting that it is mere cronyism.
The struggle takes many forms. I think the issue here is that, well, it's one of these irregular verbs. You know, all party political leaders attack the other side when they appoint, you know, members of their staff to the House of Lords for essentially having worked for them, being the primary qualification for being a legislator for life, and yet then when offered the opportunity to do so, they do the same. I think the Carrie Murphy one is going to be particularly controversial because of this ongoing Equality and Human Rights Commission investigation into the Labour Party, and the question of what that investigation might end up saying about her and her role. I suspect at the next Labour leadership hustings, there will be questions asked about this and who is in favour of it and who's not in favour of it. Because I think this will become a kind of totemic question of, you know, which bits of the Corbyn project and the Corbynite control of the party are you prepared to break with or to denounce?
I thought it was quite an extreme response from the Conservatives that they've suggested moving the House of Lords to York as a result of the possibility of John Bercow and Carrie Murphy being in it. But, you know, as James says, that there are a lot of issues with the House of Lords. Now, I'm not sure just moving it geographically would be a way of solving it either. I mean, firstly, the rationale behind moving the upper chamber to another city in the country that's not London is to try to reconnect politicians with the electorate. Well, I mean, the House of Lords isn't elected, which is a bit of a problem. I'm not sure that when you look at sort of public anger towards politicians, which has always been high, every year we say, oh, people have never been angrier with politicians, but they've always been quite angry with politicians. And actually, the peers don't really feature in that anger. It's about MPs and it's about the people who they feel they've elected and paid for to go to Parliament to make decisions on their behalf. And the House of Commons is the primary chamber. So if you wanted to make some kind of big symbolic gesture about Parliament being in touch with the electorate, then surely you would move the House of Commons or Parliament in its entirety, as some people like, you know, Chukwuemunna have proposed, rather than just farming out the House of Lords in a very expensive operation that no one will really understand. And I wonder almost whether it will become a little bit, not that I think it would actually happen, whether it would become a little bit like the European Parliament moving back and forth from Brussels to Strasbourg for symbolic reasons, with not even the people who are decamping the whole time and catching the train really understanding why they're having to do this.
That perhaps it will become one of those growing list of issues that is discussed by the government and then because of bandwidth is put on hold for the time being.
Which is weird because they're so into delivery. They're so, you know, they during the election, I remember talking to people on the campaign who said, we are all about under-promising and over-delivering. And now they've won. They're like, yeah, we're just going to propose anything, move the House of Lords to York. Why suddenly this sort of incontinence when it comes to policy?
Thank you, Isabel. Thank you, James. And while we have you here, I'm going to plug another event. This time it is it time to offer amnesty to Britain's illegal immigrants? This is a spectator panel, and arguing that it is time will be Fraser Nelson alongside our new economics correspondent, Kate Andrews, and suggesting this isn't the right way forward will be David Goodhart. This event's happening on the 25th of February, which is a Tuesday at 7 p.m. at the Emmanuel Centre. And to buy yourself a ticket, just go to www.spectator.co.uk/amnestypodcast.